Our guests now have some ambitious proposals for what to do with the electricity from the Manapouri Power Station once the Tiwai Point aluminium smelter is shut down by Rio Tinto as soon as a year from now. The smelter currently uses 13% of the country's power production. The obvious solution is to put that power back into the national grid to be transported north, which would require infrastructure being upgraded in order to connect it. But are there other options which could create different jobs in Southland? The McDiarmid Institute says there are many such options, including manufacturing silicon solar panels, using the power to produce hydrogen, and developing energy storage. Well, with us are Professor Sally Brooker from the Department of Chemistry at the University of Otago. Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome also to Professor David Williams, Principal Investigator at the McDiarmid Institute for Advanced Materials and Nanotechnology and Auckland University Emeritus Professor of Chemical Sciences. Hi, David.
Morena, Catherine.
Sally, let's look first at the initial idea, which is that with some spending, some many millions, I think hundreds of millions of actually, spending, you could link the production from the Manapouri Power Station to the national grid. What are the pros and cons of simply linking it up?
Well, to be honest, I can pretty much only see cons. I'm not an economist, and I think what we need is an economic analysis of the benefits of putting that power back into the grid. And I'm happy to discuss that in more detail, but as you pointed out, it's a huge infrastructure cost, $500 million New Zealand or more, in order to get that power all the way from one end of the country to the other. And in doing that, as Nicola Gaston pointed out recently, you lose about half the power probably in the form of heat, because it's got to travel along a lot of wires and go through across under the sea and so on. And we're talking about the sort of amount of power that powers Christchurch and Wellington together, about 770,000 households. That's how much power is going into Tiwai currently. So if you lose half of that, you've lost, you know, all the power that Christchurch consumes. So what we should be doing is keeping the power in Bluff and using those skilled labour, the labour force there, to generate clever products on site.
What are some of the options that you've researched, at least from the scientific perspective? Because the economics will get interesting, I'm sure. But let's talk about the scientific potential.
Yes, absolutely. We need the economists to work out the cases. So the McDiarmid Institute has several suggestions. My favourite is hydrogen. Again, I hasten to say I don't understand the economic side of it. But green hydrogen, in other words, hydrogen made by electrolysers from water, using electricity from renewable sources, which is exactly what we have. We've got hydropower from Manapouri flooding in, is a growth industry. At the moment, most hydrogen in the world is made using petroleum products, and so it's what we call brown or black or, you know, grubby hydrogen. It's not the actual hydrogen itself, it's the process, because it's making greenhouse gas emissions. So that's bad stuff, and we want to replace that with green hydrogen. But it's relatively rare. I think in Germany, for example, only about 7% of their hydrogen is made in a green way, because they have a lot of nuclear and coal-fired power stations. We have a benefit in New Zealand. We already have a very green electrical sector. So we could go big into hydrogen. And most countries are putting out big hydrogen policies. So Germany in June put out a national hydrogen strategy, and they're putting 9 billion euros, which is about 16 billion New Zealand dollars, into getting their hydrogen economy really up to speed.
Can I pause you?
Can I find the eight ball and we should get onto it?
Can I pause you at hydrogen and just could you give us an idea of what its potential uses are?
Absolutely.
And second, what the limitations have been? We've talked about hydrogen cards for many years on the show, and I recall questions of volatility and safety and feasibility ultimately of where the technology had got to. What is its potential?
Cool, I can definitely address that. Yep. So, I mean, electrolyzers to make hydrogen are commercially available, and there are many, many installations going on in the world. And every time you read the latest news, you find out that there's an even bigger one gone in somewhere new. So this is an exponential growth in terms of producing hydrogen. In terms of its uses, there are already lots of demonstration vehicles, cars, trucks, buses, trains, you name it, that can be run on hydrogen. And one of the, we have, for example, the Hyundai demonstration cars in New Zealand, and the beauty of these vehicles is they only produce water when they burn the hydrogen in the fuel cell on board. So they're really the ultimate green transportation option. And, of course, while we've got a very green electricity supply, we don't have a green transport sector, and we could have.
Do they have, a question to each of you, do they have any emissions that en masse could get interesting in an as-yet unforeseen way? Any chemical reactions as a result? Can either of you speak to that?
I don't think
you get water vapour.
Byproduct.
That's it?
Just water.
Okay. Carry on, Sally.
Oh, sorry. So just to give one example, in Germany they've put some hydrogen-powered trains onto a line that they haven't electrified because it's considered too remote to be worth electrifying, and I immediately think of the Auckland-Wellington train line, which isn't fully electrified, so it has to run diesel trains. Well, their answer to that is to put a hydrogen-powered train on there, and it's running alongside the diesel trains with absolutely no sacrifice in performance. It's got the same range, it can be refueled fast, and they've got 41 of these trains, and they're very happy with them, and more orders are going in, and they see that as part of the answer, that it's nice and quiet, and it only emits water. The biggest thing, as I say, is to actually make the hydrogen in a green-friendly way, and that's where New Zealand has a huge advantage, because we've got a nearly 100% renewable electricity sector already, and that's what you need. That plus water gives you hydrogen in a green-friendly way.
And how would we use it? Would we start producing vehicles again, which we abandoned back in the 80s? How is it exportable, and in what form?
Yep. Okay, so we would be able to make the hydrogen... we could make masses of hydrogen in Tiwai, because obviously the amount of power pouring in there is enormous, and so it would be something we could use. For example, Real Journeys are quite interested down in their tours through Milford and Doubtful Sound and so on to use hydrogen-powered coaches so that they have a green experience of a green, you know, environment. So we could make a lot of hydrogen there and start really seriously converting our transportation from diesel and petrol-based to hydrogen-based, with the only byproduct being water. We can also export hydrogen. It can be easily shipped places, either by train or by marine, and indeed marine vehicles can run on hydrogen too. These are not research questions. There are operational vehicles available in all of these sectors, and it's just a matter of catching up with the world, actually. I think Europe's way ahead of us on a hydrogen on the hydrogen front as part of a future energy plan for New Zealand. Because, as I say, while we've got a very green electricity sector, we don't have a green transport sector. And hydrogen has a huge advantage of being fast to refuel, particularly your heavy vehicles and your coaches and so on. Your buses running on hydrogen is very attractive because they can refuel them fast. You don't have to have it parked up for the night and there's your million-dollar a vehicle sitting there waiting to charge. You know, that's the problem with EVs.
Well, is there an infrastructure barrier to all this? With the EVs,
yes.
We know that we need the sort of the spine of charging stations, for example.
Yes.
But what are,
yes.
what are the restrictions at the moment? Is it simply the number of car manufacturers and the number of cars that could be available quickly to take hydrogen? Is there another infrastructural barrier to scaling up?
Okay, so there is an infrastructure barrier in the sense that just as you need EV charging stations, you need hydrogen refueling stations. And, of course, there has to be appropriate international regulation of the style of couplings and so on used on the vehicles and in the stations so that you don't have the sort of crazy thing with EVs where a Tesla can charge at one station but a Nissan Leaf has to go to a different one because the coupling's different, whatever. You know, there's a regulatory framework to get right. And clearly, also, you need to be able to pull up at a station to refuel. This is clear. Yep.
The other options that are very interesting, the use of silica to create solar panels. These are subjects we've looked at previously on the show some years ago, in fact, and battery storage aligned to it. What's the link up with what could be happening in Southland with that much extra power? What do you envisage?
Well, there's a source of silica in Southland, and there's a lot of electricity. So one of the things to understand, it's not just one process, but it's a connected set of major industrial processes, and each one of these generates useful byproducts. And normally they're done by different companies in different places, but we can think how to join these up in one location and then maximise efficiency and minimise input impact. So what goes in is silica, which is a quartz sand, wood, seawater, electricity, and out come solar cells, biodiesel and other chemicals, chlorine and caustic soda, and you also get silicon in various grades of purity, silicon chemicals and hydrogen, depending on the different parts of the whole process are balanced. I mean, you can even use the outputs like the waste heat and carbon dioxide to sort of soup up greenhouses. So it's a very interesting system. It needs a lot of electricity, and you need to think about the whole thing. So the first stage is you take the silica to what's called metallurgical grade silicon, which is impure form of silicon. And so you put the silica and carbon into an electric arc furnace, and the carbon comes from trees and forest waste and biomass, and using that source is an established process, and New Zealand companies involved in that. And then what comes out is this metallurgical grade silicon, and you get carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, so you have to capture that. And again, there was the New Zealand company LanzaTech, which has a great process for doing that, and you can use waste heat as well. Now, the metallurgical grade silicon is not a super high value product. It's a bit of a commodity, a bit like aluminium, so you don't want to be trapped in that sludge again. So you need to purify the silicon to a solar grade silicon, which is a much higher purity. And this is a very high-tech chemical process that you can use to direct to form crystalline silicon, the sort that goes in these rigid panels, or thin film silicon, which you have in flexible solar cells like those that have just been installed on the Emirates Team New Zealand base, or might be used in solar roofing. And this process uses hydrogen and chlorine to convert the crude silicon into liquid silicon compounds that you purify by distillation, then convert back into high-purity silicon. And to do that, you need a really high-skilled workforce and a really high-quality industry, because these compounds you have to treat with respect. And hydrogen and chlorine you get from seawater using electricity, basically similar process to what Sally was describing.
What's the potential again?
Why then just ship out the silicon and let someone else take the value? So the input is the solar grade silicon, and then you can go straight from the pure liquid silicon compounds and create flexible solar cells and multi-layer high efficiency cells, stuff like that. So we've got all the things we need to go all the way from the raw materials to a very high value finished product with human capital to support it.
So that's export, as you say. You're not just doing what we do, shipping logs overseas. You're doing all the value add. You're exporting a finished value-added product with enormous demand as well?
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, the installations, solar installations are growing very, very rapidly around the world, so there's terrific demand for these things. I mean, mostly they come from China, and the Chinese use coal as the carbon source. So it gets a bad rap because of that. And there remains an opportunity for us.
What would it take? This is always the question. What would it take to get there? Because are we talking about a big infrastructure investment up front? And is that going to be primarily private sector? Is it going to need considerable public sector involvement in early stages, much as some of the power schemes did? They were one or t'other, or sometimes cooperation between both. What's the scale of project that we're talking about for such an industry to get underway?
Well, it's a significant scale, Catherine. These are major industrial processes, and you can look up basically how much they cost. I figured out it would be about the cost of an Auckland motorway. So it's not peanuts. But on the other hand, what you then get is something that's a complete societal transformation as well. You use all this human capital, all these well-trained young people that we churn out, that you want to have their brain power operating in New Zealand, and then you have around it a whole lot of other connected industries, because you've got to support this infrastructure. Yes, it's a major industrial project.
It's been a long time since we've done one of those. We've had a position for a long time now where private sector investment tends to dominate in certain areas. Government might dominate in infrastructure such as roading or sometimes transport provision. But when you are talking about something on the scale, would it take a fundamental rethink? Would it need to go back to some of those projects that we've seen in earlier decades that have been game changers?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you're now talking political and societal questions where everybody has an opinion. And I have an opinion, but it's not necessarily an expert one. And so the issue that what you need for to get things like this off the ground is you need the raw materials, and you need the people, you need human capital, and you need money. And normally in the past, New Zealand's just been stymied by lack of money. If you're expecting to get this from overseas investors, then there's an issue because overseas investors like to sort of feel their investment, so they like to be able to travel and have a look at it. And in the past, this has always been an inhibition. And so you see New Zealand companies heading off overseas. LanzaTech's an example. They ended up in Chicago because the investors needed to have it near to them. Well, now the world's different. And also what we've got in this new situation is the money. I mean, our credit's good and money is cheap and the government's borrowing a huge pile of it. So it's like when you borrow money yourself, what are you going to do with it?
Sally?
If I could just comment there too, I think it's a problem that we've got this power is going to be flooding back into the grid in a year's time with Tiwai's closure, but it highlights our vulnerability if you have an international company that just decides to close its doors down there. But it's also an amazing opportunity, and I think we've already got the power flooding in there. A lot of countries would be very jealous to have that much green electricity arriving to a lovely site with a great harbour and a skilled workforce. And we have ways and means to help fund that through government. The Provincial Growth Fund is doing the just transition funding, I think, of Taranaki to try and get new energy options happening there, including hydrogen production. In fact, they're putting electrolysers in there. They're going to build a wind farm to generate the power to run those electrolysers to make green hydrogen to feed into the fertiliser plant up there. So there's the Provincial Growth Fund. There's COVID recovery. We have to do things to try and recover economically from COVID-19, so we're investing money in various things. So maybe some of those funds, I don't know. But ultimately, we're trying to move towards a Zero Carbon Act, meeting that and reducing our greenhouse emissions and so on. So government-wise, there must be a few options there for how you might facilitate the sort of infrastructure change. I think the hydrogen-powered plant, hydrogen production would probably be a far simpler process than silica. But, of course, what we need is a proper economic analysis of these options because, as David said, we might have our favourites, but we don't know the economics. We just know these have got to be considered as options.
To that point on the hydrogen, one of the challenges we found with the transition to EVs is simply getting the vehicles to New Zealand at a price anyone can afford to pay and getting enough second-hand fleet, and that has been an enormous hold-up on that particular transition. So each possibility tends to come with its own complications. Could I just ask you, David, about the silica as the source product, I guess. How much of it is there? It needs to be mined. How much of there is there? Would there be a sunset on that as a viable industry? And would it mean an upscaling of mining that could create some issues?
Well, there are large deposits in Southland. I can't recall the exact scale of them. And yes, you do have to mine it. But silica also comes out of geothermal waters. In fact, it's a nuisance. It clogs the pipes up. And so we have other sources there as well. So that I don't think is a limitation. And then the other thing about these processes from silica, from sand through to silicon, these are established industrial processes. Essentially, you can buy the plants and put them in, so it just doesn't need to be a great big long procedure. Things I've read, it takes about a year.
I'd love to stay out of the politics for your own sake, but it's impossible not to. How are these ideas being communicated through to people who are currently spending tens of billions of dollars and are talking about the fact that two sets of problems at least have to be solved with the scale of spending? How are these ideas making their way through for consideration?
Well, talking listening to you, Catherine, is one good way of doing it. People tend to listen to the radio, and then it gets into their consciousness. But then there's another organisation around called the New Zealand Product Accelerator, which is a big sort of connected kind of organisation around through industry, and they're well connected into MBIE, and I guess it's in MBIE that the ministry that the decisions will get made. And ultimately, it depends on the politicians deciding what they want to do, and what do we want to do as a society.
The question of storage.
Roads, or do we want to build significant industrial infrastructure?
Yes, well, that was my point. We haven't been doing a lot of it with public funding anyway for several decades, and that's the interesting leap that someone's got to make at some point, possibly, if this is going to happen. But David, just on the storage matter very quickly as well, or Sally, this might be you as well. The government, of course, is looking at this business of bringing storage lakes, I just can't think of the word at the moment.
Pumped hydro,
that's right. Okay, as a means of storage or managing between high inflow and low inflow periods. How far advanced is battery storage now? I know one of your colleagues has been working for many years on the storage issue and the size of batteries and the rapidly reducing size of batteries. But what is possible by means of battery storage? And is that still in a completely different league if you were looking at another option for smoothing dry years?
No, it's not an out of off the wall idea. I mean, firstly, South Australia bought an enormous battery off from Tesla as a backup storage system, and that appears to be working pretty fine. And secondly, there are, when you start to think of large scale battery storage, then there are a number of options that are around as well. Some are more developed than others, and one interesting option are advanced batteries based on aluminium. So there's things called aluminium air batteries that have been around for a long time. And one of the issues about those is you have to recycle the used aluminium and the used electrolyte, the liquid inside it. And it sort of helps if you have a handy smelter around, which we do have. So there are some other things that come into play when you start to think broadly.
Thank you both.
Technology's not the problem. I mean, technology's coming out of our ears all over the world, and what matters is the political push and the availability of the funds to make it happen.
Sally?
I was just going to say that the other option in storage is to take a leaf out of nature's book and store the energy in chemical bonds, and that's effectively what you're doing when you electrolyse water and make hydrogen, because you can burn that hydrogen when you feel like it, not just when the hydro was running or the sun was shining or the wind was blowing. So the renewable electricity can be captured either into hydrogen or indeed reducing carbon dioxide into liquid fuels would also be a really cool thing, but that's a little bit more in the research phase than the actual rubber hitting the road phase, which hydrogen's already at.
Thanks both of you. I'm sure we'll talk again. Professor Sally Brooker from the Department of Chemistry at the University of Otago, Professor David Williams, Principal Investigator at the McDiarmid Institute for Advanced Materials and Nanotechnology, also Auckland University Emeritus Professor of Chemical Sciences.